This is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Lehman, Jay, and Mark, and today we will be continuing with the Pan-Pacifica Cosm cards. We'll be finishing them off 12 to 20, but before we get into those, we do have an email that I would like to read. And you also can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com, and we will also read your emails and answer questions or make comments, etc. So on to the email. This is from Antonio. Hi, guys. Thanks for all the excellent work you're doing. Your podcast is one of my week's high points, and I always look forward to it. Well, thank you very much for the compliment. That's why we are doing this.
Appreciate that.
Following one of your episodes about DSRs, I have been thinking recently about how else to use the DSR section of the drama deck. So far, three ideas have come to mind, and I was hoping for your opinions and suggestions. The first would be for variety in combat, each step represents one of the enemy's combat options. Examples such as A would be Intimidate, B is Taunt, C is Attack, D is Fireball. I'm pretty sure one of you suggested this, in fact. The second one is for changeable combat environments like a crashing plane, a rolling truck down a mountainside, where each step would represent a change in the combat environment. A, the gear shakes loose, B, the floor becomes the ceiling, C, a free fall, and D, impact. Or for an MMORPG flavor, characters could have ability sets whose cooldowns end on a given step. Examples of A being Fire Dart, B being Firebolt, C being Fireball, D being Rain of Fire. Is there anyone who's done a count of how many times each step occurs? My suggestions assume that each step appears less frequently than the one before it. As ever, thanks for taking the time to read and answer. So thank you very much for that email, and we'll do a little discussion on that. Jay, what are your thoughts on using the DSR steps for non-DSR things, either environment or for an enemy or cooldowns and the like?
Well, messing around with the DSR letters is kind of my jam. That's what I do. I know I've talked about I'm not really requiring a DSR every adventure, but I do like to use the letters on the drama cards a lot. I'm pretty sure it was me talking about enemy attacks previously, because I have put that in an adventure on the Infiniverse. And you are kind of correct about the frequency. I believe there's 26 A's, 26 B's, 16 C's, 16 D's. And then two of each of the dilemmas. So the C's and D's are rarer, but A's and B's have an equal amount. So looking at all those three things, I think I've done most of those. As far as like the MMORPG cooldown, I did it kind of like in fourth edition D&D, they would have monsters have like a big ability, especially like a dragon breath weapon or something. And then you would roll a die each turn, and if you rolled a certain number, they get it back. So this would be the same thing. It comes back on a C or a D or something like that. The one about changeable combat environments, is I kind of do that in my chases, but by what step you're on, not by the letter on the card. And the main reason for that is because so many of the cards have multiple letters on them. So if you get an A, B, C... from your example, that would be the gear shakes loose, floor becomes the ceiling, and you're in free fall. It would be a lot all at once. You got to really think about that. But I was thinking before we started about some examples of some things that have been printed. One, and I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this previously, there's rules in Revenge of the Caradon for battles at sea that use these. It's kind of a sort of stylized chase sequence, but not really a chase. It's like a mixture of a DSR and a chase that use them. So you can check those out. So I did do one where, yes, the letters are the different attacks. So without saying exactly what it's from or what's going on, A would be a fireball. Like the enemy is in this situation is focusing on something. So they're not like directly fighting the players, but if, depending on what letter comes up, he can do something. So A is a fireball. B is a bar guest gets summoned out of lava. C is casting sudden burial, and D is casting a whirlwind. Because of where this occurs, it's pretty dangerous. So C and D being less common can be more powerful than the others. Another one that I've done previously, and I think we've talked about this, but some enjoyed it, some did not enjoy it, but there is a dance off in one adventure that and so in this case it's not progressing a DSR, it's just saying what kind of music is being played and what kind of a dance would go with that. And so it tells what kind of skill check you can make. So A means that it's footwork that you're going to be needing. B is twerking. C is moshing, and D is thrashing. And they all sort of require different skill tests and have different things that can occur with them. And then the final one, it's something I haven't actually finished yet. And at this rate, I don't know if it's ever going to finish, so I might as well just talk about it, where it's a infected horde assaulting a PC bang, one of those like internet cafe kind of things, except it's in South Korea. And it's being like barricaded, and there's survivors inside. So all the different entrances were different letters. There's the front entrance is A, the back entrance is B, the windows on the side are C, and then the stairs going up to the second story is D. And then the players could barricade different areas to increase their strength. And then every time a card would get drawn at the beginning of the round, that would indicate which areas got more reinforcements of infected. And if the infected ever overwhelmed the number of defenders there, they would destroy the barricades and get in. So there's a little bit more to it, but those are just some things that I've done. I really like the design space that the cards have. Just the letters on them lets you do a bunch of cool things. So I might do it too much, to be honest. It is possible to overdo these things, but I like playing around with them. And if everything goes well, we may see some of that in year two as well.
Mark, your thoughts on using DSR letters and other things in that space instead of just as DSRs or chases?
Torg Eternity is unique in the gaming space and the role-playing game space to have the cards as a thing that that's involved in how the game is played. Most every other that I'm aware of RPG that's out there is dice and paper maps and minis, right? Which you can do in Torg Eternity too, but I tend to run it more theater of the mind. But the cards are another tool that allows us as GMs to bring other things into the game that are just really cool. I love the mechanic and the nature of having A, B, C, and D on a card when you're flipping them over. And I'm with Jay on this. I love pulling something that the players haven't seen before, that's different, that's new, that's, oh wait, we're doing what? And you start flipping cards, and it's a fun, to me it's fun to have that mechanic come in. The idea that you would trigger the threat, you've got these threats, and that you would trigger them to use one of their abilities off of the letter on the card, though I kind of disagree with, just because you don't tend to have mindless threats in Torg Eternity. Most of them are intelligent in some way, and so they're not going to just trigger like whatever is tied to a B on the card because that's what flipped up if it didn't make any sense. Oh yeah, I'm going to shoot my gun now. Well, we're in melee and I can't shoot my submachine gun because I'm in melee. I'm better at punching and whatever. And so it just, if you want to run it that way, knock yourself out. But I think that's a, that's not a great use of the A, B, C, and D. Though the your middle idea with the gear shakes loose and the floor becomes, I love that. That's, I think that's a great idea. And I've done some similar things where you set up environmental effects for a regular combat, and you're turning cards anyway in a combat already. And so you have A, B, C, and D, but as Jay pointed out, you're going to have to figure out, well, what happens if I've got multiple ones? I tackled that by assigning scenario, seniority to A's, B's, C's, and D's, and D's more. If you got a D, you're not going to get a, if you got an A on the card and a B, the B was more important, and so the B thing happened. If you got A, B, and C, the C thing happened. So whatever. So if A came up by itself, which I don't know if that, I hadn't even looked to see if that's, if A is on there by itself, but you don't get C by itself or a D by itself. I don't think you get those in pairs. Which is how I addressed it on there, was the more senior letter goes off, or if you'd already done one, you make a mark and then you go to the next one. Great idea to trigger some random stuff that you're like, oh, now suddenly stalagmites fall from the cave roof, and you know, now you've got to dodge this on top of fighting the cavemen or whatever's in there. The thing that I like to do with DSRs and those A, B, C, and D's is I like to, on my steps, I like to assign levels of success. Not just a, here's a DN, beat the DN, you accomplish the step. I love the idea that the levels of success in things like that matter. And so on future tasks, either individual tasks or other DSRs, I like to reference, well, if you completed this thing back here with a good success, you get a bonus to this step. It makes it easier. If you get it outstanding on this thing back here, well, you got a +4 here. Or maybe it's, you're an automatic, if you want a higher level of success on this step, you have to attempt it. Failures make it harder, that kind of thing. And so levels of success have consequences and matter to events that happen later on in the game. And it just, to me, it makes a lot of sense that you use the A, B, C, and D's in DSRs to like trigger a step that causes you to have to have that, because then levels of success, we have standard good and outstanding levels of success, so why not tie them to other things? But absolutely, if you come up with some ideas on ways to use those letters that are on that card in ways that we haven't mentioned, I think you should absolutely run with that, because that's innovative and cool and makes the game fresh, and your players will have a good time with it.
Yeah, I'll agree. For your second point, if there is a sequence of things that have to happen in order on the cards that have the multiple letters, I would just have whichever the next step is. So if, say, the gear shake loose, the floor becomes a ceiling, or we're talking about being in a truck, say, rolling down a mountainside, so it's flipping over, there's a free fall, and then an impact. If there was your very first card was A, B, C, or D, I would just count it as A. You need to get past step A. So A, the gear shakes loose. The next round, if there's a B, then the floor becomes a ceiling. I wouldn't do the whole thing in once, because then that just kind of takes away the drama. I mean, it makes that one scene really crazy, or that one round really crazy, but then you don't get the setup of the players going, oh, what's going to happen next, which I think is kind of cool. I completely agree with Jay on the cooldowns. I wouldn't necessarily use them on spells, but I would perhaps if I came up with some special ability that would be cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
But
that's cool.
I wouldn't want it to occur every round. then I would do that as a, if you know, and then you can use the A, B, C, or D depending on how often you would want a recharge of that ability. I think that is great. Also, I'll kind of go with Mark on the, I wouldn't necessarily use it as a, this is what the enemy does, but I would do it maybe as an option or an additional option for an enemy that, you know, they could do this and intimidate and maybe not have a multi-action penalty. one of the things, and I think this is probably what we discussed more previously, was if you're coming up with something, I would encourage, and I think Jay was on the same page, if my memory didn't just go out the window, is the A, B, C, or D's are more likely to happen in an encounter than if you're trying to turn it into an approved action or have it occur when an approved action happens or something on the conflict line, like an inspiration or a fatigue. So, like such and such occurs when a fatigue happens or when a taunt is approved action. Sometimes you will get through an entire encounter and that will not happen because it's more rare. If you want something that is not going to happen every round, maybe, but has a chance of not happening, and you want that more in the middle, then that's where I would use those numbers, or the letters A, B, C, and D instead of the approved actions or a additional thing to something on the conflict line. So no, those are good things to think about. Always use the cards. I know there was some confusion when whatever the first rule or perk or special ability said, when a critical problem or something appears, then this thing happens. And a lot of people were like, well, what if you're not in a DSR? What if you're not in a DSR? And to just make sure everybody understands, while the DSR uses those letters are not intricately tied to a DSR only, that they can be used for other things. But no, use those letters, even maybe have something as a critical problem. If you only wanted a very low chance of a super cool special ability that you don't want to trigger often, but maybe have a 2-time chance, then throw in it recharges on a dilemma or a critical problem. You can kind of stage those out. You could even do it as I need an A, B, C, and D, because then you know that's even lower. You can make a chart saying what every single breakdown is and throw those in. So thank you very much for writing in. Hopefully that gave you some ideas, and we seems like we all encourage you to use that drama card, use those letters to make the game more interesting. And I actually really like that. If you're in a truck and it's tumbling down the mountain, not necessarily making it a DSR, but having those steps happen, I think is a pretty cool idea. So thanks for that. And anybody can write us at torgdcd@gmail.com, and we'll do the same with your email. So let's move on to the Pan Pacifica Cosm cards. So we are on card number 12, Fist of Fury. For the remainder of the scene, unarmed combat is favored, is a favorite skill for all player characters. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on Fists of Fury?
I guess they probably haven't changed much since the first video, because this is the same as number 6.
True.
So,
I was like, I'm pretty sure we did that one, but I guess I didn't see that
we
one
did.
Quickly.
Yeah.
So, yes, just sorry. We already discussed that. Look at the previous
episode. Everybody punch stuff.
Yeah.
And then we'll move on to 13. 13, I believe, is different. Kanawa's tendrils play at the start of a combat. Once during this combat, at the start of a round, instead of flipping a drama card, the GM may pick up the top 4 cards, choose one, and discard the rest. All Storm Knights gain one possibility at the end of the round, and I know Mark loves this card, but Jay, what are your thoughts on this card first?
I like this card. Yeah, it's nice. Because the thing is that it's worded, and it's kind of like assumed that the GM's going to make life hard for you, but they don't have to. You know, depending on what combat it is, they might just be like, man, I just got to get through this. Let's just give them a really good card to start with and paste these Jiangxi and we'll be on our way. Or if it's a vital combat, you can tailor it however you like. And it's not like it's any card. It's just from the top 4. So the GM has some choice, but not a huge amount of choice to screw you over if that's what you're worried about, which is also why it's probably only worth one possibility. That said, I'm sure there are players who would love to see the GM do that and then immediately use a psychic power or something to then rearrange those cards, but or at least look ahead to see what's going on. But I would still give them the possibility for that.
Mark, your thoughts on Kanawa's tendrils?
Revenge of the GM Fiat. I like this card so much. I can't tell you how much I like this card because GM Fiat no longer exists in the game, and that's an old school functionality that got brought back in the second half of the Kanawha and the Pan Pacific cards, and it's just stupendous. And it's not, as Jay pointed out, it's not the let me go find the absolute worst card that I can slap down and just take advantage of my players. It's flexibility that the GM can use that if I'm absolutely wearing you out and I want to give you a break, I can find this card that gives you a slide that out there. By the same token, it might have some really cool stuff that I can let my threats do that make the situation more dramatic, more interesting, more fun, and rather than just taking what comes next. Plus, in the player's advantage, to the player's advantage, I have to discard the other three cards. So if I pick up four really good cards, or whatever you want to call really good, if I pick up four cards and three of them are absolutely horrific, 38, 39, 40 happen to come up, and then 25 or whatever, I have to get rid of those other cards. They don't go back on the deck. I'm not rearranging and putting it back down, and then they come up in the order I want, which is what the players get to do to me all the time, right? I have to get rid of those three cards so you never see them. So even if I'm looking to, like, you guys are breezing through it, and we got to make this a little more challenging. Let's put the hard card down. I get rid of the other three. So there's an advantage. You only get, and that's, to me, that's an added benefit to the players that there are three cards that just got discarded that are could be to their advantage as opposed to, yeah, I get to stack it up and then really pound you into the dirt.
I think talk. I don't remember which episode it was, but I think I talked about how there is a time where I actually did invoke the classic Tor Game Master Fiat because my party was just in the first two rounds going to completely get wiped out because of bad obstacles getting stacked and bad, drama card and just bad roles and good roles for the villains and such. So having a card like this is good for the game master. When you have conflicting type things, like Jay brought up, there are certain psychic abilities and things that will allow a player to rearrange cards and such. If there's a conflict, I would just say who did it first. So if the game master played this first, then that's what occurs, and then the players change after. But if the players did it first and they lined up their cards, then the game master would play it after that. Maybe if a player keeps doing it round after round so the game master can't do it, well then if that's all right with you, I wouldn't give them the possibility. Because it says at the end, or it says at the end of the round, so you're not going to get that possibility unless it's played. So I would hope that the players would, if they're playing the card, I hope that they would want play it because they wanted that possibility, and then allow the game master to actually play it. If not, then it's just a wasted card, no possibility. But that would be on the players, not on the game master. So that would be my thoughts on that. So let's move on to card number 14, Black Market Gene Mods, sorry. Play to gain $5,000 worth of Gene Mods for the act and gain two possibilities. At the end of the act, roll a die on a 1 through 4, make a defeat test. Or play at the end of an act to remove up to $5,000 worth of gene mods and replace them with new gene mods. Any remainder may be saved for later purchases. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on black market gene mods?
This card is kind of weird. I'm not really sure what I think about it. I did like Sure, the odds of you failing a defeat test or even having to make a defeat test are really slim, but you still have to make one, and it's so it's possible that you could play this card and then just die at the end, unceremoniously turned into like a pile of salt or whatever. So I don't really like that, and I don't really like, I don't know, just the idea of temporarily getting gene mods or cybernetics or occult tech or something just doesn't really seem right to me. Especially gene mods, like I'm pretty sure they're not injected and then they just whoosh, appear right away. Like I would imagine they take time, to actually grow. So I don't really like this card, I guess, lore wise, I would say. Mechanically, it could be good. It depends on what you're doing, like, and how, if this is your character's first run through, hey, an extra 5K of gene mods, why not? I don't know if I would ever use the second part of it, to be honest, like, unless you really realize that you screwed up with your gene mod purchases, I would probably just take the perk again to get more instead of using that. But I guess it's an option for people. It's only 5,000, so it's not even for like the full third gen gene mods either, which is I think 8,000. And the way a lot of the gene mods are, there's usually like one big one. Like when you make your purchase, like you can get one big one and then like a couple of small ones usually. So it's not necessarily always going to be enough, 5,000. So I don't really like this card too much. It just seems weird. I don't really know what else to say about it.
Mark, your thoughts on black market gene mods?
I'm okay with it. The gene mod, I mean, I could conceivably see them growing the bio squirt as an individual thing, and then now we're going to tack this on. It gets installed here, and so we've hastily done it, and that's why there's a defeat test potentially at the end, because your body rejected it, or you got an infection or whatever, and you got a problem. I can see that. It's not very clear though on roll a die. So is that a BD or is that a D20? I would assume it's a D20, because you typically it means a D6 when you roll a BD. So that's a disconnection, a four case contradiction. It does also doesn't give you any prerequisites to get these gene mods installed. So, anybody can do it, which from my perspective, I'd probably play it with a non-Pan Pacifica character, just because it would be cool to be, an Adinos running around with, BioSquirt or whatever gene mods installed, or to have somebody from, a Rorsch suddenly have this cool stuff going on. That, that would, to me, that to me is inherently Torg, and I like that idea. The idea, the second half of it, or play at the end of the act to remove up to five, you've decided you want to swap out gene mods. I don't know why that is even necessary to be on the card if you decide you want to swap out the gene mods. Work with your game master. It's like swapping out cyberware. If you can find a chop shop, you could, maybe there's prerequisites. They'd have to find a doctor who successfully can roll. I think there's rules for that. In the Cyber Papacy book, as far as cybernetics go, I don't see why you couldn't do that with gene mods too. I misread that initially though, and was thinking, crap, why they get kind of like two thirds of a perk here for free. And then it wasn't, I didn't miss the or, like they just get, oh wait, I play this card and I just get $5,000 worth of gene mods. That's cool. I want to get this card. And then as Jay was talking, was, oh no, it's if I already have the gene mods, I can rotate them out, because I've decided I don't really like these. I'd like to get some other ones. So I don't know. Maybe it has a use for that part, and Liaman gets the last word on this, and he can explain that on whether or not there's, you can do it normally, or you've got to do something extraordinary, like get this card or something else. I don't know, but I'm okay with it. I could. It doesn't bother me as much as it bothers Jay with gene mods, just spontaneously. Oh, here, let's put this in. Oh, geez. Okay.
So my thoughts are for the first part, which is not the rearranging of money of gene mods, but just the hey, I get these $5,000 worth of gene mods that are going to last an act. I'm going to gain two possibilities. That's nice. And then I'm going to make a defeat test. That is the D20. If it doesn't specifically say BD and it says roll a die, that means the D20. But a 10%, no, it would be a 20, sorry, 20% chance of making a
25.
Defeat.
5, 10, 15,
20?
20.
Yeah.
Math hard. It's been a long day.
Yeah, 20% chance of making a defeat test, and then even if you succeed, that might be a temporary injury, that might be a permanent injury. Is that worth a one-act thing? The risk and reward, I'll say my biggest gripe is that it's not fast. This is going to be played by a player who is then going to spend time thinking about what they want to apply. And if they are not from Pan Pacifica and don't have the source book, they're going to get the source book and they're going to think about every single dollar or $10, $25. And hopefully that wouldn't stop the game, but it's a lot of time for this, in my opinion. Now, the second part, while there are no specific rules about swapping out gene mods or cyberware or occult tech, if that's something that a player in my game would want to do, I would say you could do that. I wouldn't do it on the fly. I would do it between long periods of downtime. In classic Torg, you actually took wounds and then you had to heal those wounds like naturally to be able to get back. Torg Eternity does not have that, but I would say, you know, after an act, if it's not, I'm ending an act and I'm immediately starting a new act right afterwards, I would allow that. But this is like a free rearrangement, so that's just... If you're going the way that Mark and I would say fine, then it's not really worth it. And then, as Jay was saying, if you only allow this card to allow you to swap out, hopefully you would have picked what you wanted, or, you know, shortly, like after the first adventure, oh, sorry, Game Master, this was not anything like what I thought it would be. Could I swap it out? Hopefully your Game Master would be up. So the card... I like the idea, but I just see a lot of flaws within the execution. The second part, because I don't really see it necessary in the first part, because I could see my players just wanting to halt the game while they look. You know, it'd almost be like a character creation before the game type thing. At least the second part says it's at the end of the act to remove, so you're not doing that switching in the middle of an act, but the first one just says you get it right then and there. So
I might tell you, if you're the player and you have this card and you're like, oh, I want to do this, like, okay, you can play that when you know what you want. You can't play that until you know what you want, because we're going to keep doing the game and we'll retcon the fact that you had this installed and you just haven't used it prior to that. But you have to figure out when you figure out what you want, okay, we'll play it. So that puts the emphasis on figuring it out on the player, that the longer they take to nitpick and get into the minutia, the less time in the mission they have to use their new toys. So that's I think that would make that solve your problem with that, because it's a legitimate concern.
Right.
Yeah. If you stop the game to wait for them to figure out what they want, like a requisition. Well, okay, we're going to figure out what he wants on his requisition, and everybody go, you know, let's go order pizza, cook a meal, whatever. Yeah, that's going to take some time.
So I've also always look at it like the two possibilities you get. Mm-hmm. One is kind of just earmarked
for that defeat test. Exactly.
Right. All right. So you're really only getting one.
You're getting one and a hopefully I didn't roll. I guess it's just a die roll, so it's not there's no mishaps. So
yeah.
It's not a guaranteed defeat test, though.
Well, yeah, you would save the possibility for the defeat test, but the 1 through 4 isn't necessarily a test, so it's just a...
No, that's not a test.
So that's
no, just, you roll the die. You don't make the defeat test unless you roll a 1, 2, 3, or a 4. If you roll a 5 through 20...
Then that possibility ends up being wasted, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Otherwise,
So how much of a gambler are you, I
I was
guess?
gonna say, there you go. It would suck to need it and not have it.
Sold out, number 15, was also number 9, so you can go back to the last episode and check out
MVP.
What we had to say about that.
I still like that card a lot. I'd like to talk about it again, but we won't.
And then 16, Bring It On. Play at the start of a scene to challenge a reality-rated character or mob to fight in close combat. Your allies may not aid you in any way. Effects which include all allies do not include you. Gain up to 3 possibilities after defeating them, depending on the difficulty of the challenge. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on Bring It On?
I personally remove the first part that says play at the start of a scene. I have it as more as play at the start of an encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because at the beginning of a scene, you might not even be facing anyone.
You
just
might not
like,
even know if it's the first scene of the first act.
We've just hit the streets and we're looking. We heard a news report. It's like, hey, you, let's go. So I guess like you could say that they play it and you know that it's active. But I personally tell them just play it at the beginning of an encounter, like when you first meet someone that you want to challenge. And this is becomes kind of a solo dino attack situation that they make happen themselves. They are the dino this time because they see someone. It's like, let's go. I like this. I like the idea of a duel like that and not being able to cheesily get group buffs while doing it are also good. Some extreme rules lawyers might argue that keeping your allies beside you, so if a fireball hits you, means you would not be affected by it. But any GM will immediately quash that nonsense. Like with these kind of cards, you gotta read like what the intention is and not just the hard text. But yeah, otherwise, like I really like this idea. Obviously, it sucks if you get it and you're just not a combat character in any way, shape, or form. But as I mentioned last week, sometimes that could be amusing too.
Mark, your thoughts on Bring It On?
I like Jay's played it at the beginning of an encounter instead of at the beginning of the scene. I might alter that a little bit and just let you put it on the table, and then as the GM offer the encounter. Do you want to challenge somebody in this? You know, when we start the encounter, because a lot of times what happens with these cards is you forget you've got them, or if you play it and you put it on the table and then it's kind of out of sight, out of mind because it's sitting over here and you're looking at something else. And you forget that that's even there. And then after the encounters come, oh crap, I should have, that was the guy I wanted to check. And then it doesn't come up. So I might let you as a player play it. And then as the encounters unfold, go, this is an opportunity. You think you want to do it here? Because the spirit of the card is to not have the opportunity to do the one-on-one, but I don't think you want to, you know, when you come up against like Mobius, you're not going to one-on-one challenge Mobius or Reiko or whoever and get your ass handed to you. Cause that's just not the spirit of the card. And you don't get anything for that. You just smack down and you're like, well, now I'm mad I did it. Cause it didn't work out. So I think the game master having a little bit of assistance for their player to say, well, this is a fight they have a chance to win. Not necessarily, you know, it's not a cakewalk, but by the same token, they're not just going to get crushed because they chose poorly.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I would just have it as a play on a reality rated character. So, or at the beginning, you know, I'm equally happy with play at the beginning of an encounter or play it and have it left there. Playing at the start of a scene, again, I just imagine act one, scene one, everybody draws their Cosm card, somebody plays this and says, "Hey, big bad guy of the adventure, I challenge you," without even any clue who it is, and then, you know, try to use that to find information or something. So I would quash that. I do like how it specifically says that, you know, you and the person you're dueling are cut off. It's almost kind of a reality storm fight there.
Almost.
And I would do it as anything your allies try to do with you is not going to affect you. Anything that they do to hurt that mob next, you know, an area of effect that would have, I would just separate it. They're over there. Something happened that they busted through a window. They went into another little area. They can't be affected. They can't affect you. Even though these cards weren't in Classic Torg, I get reminded of this scene every once in a while where my very, very first Classic Torg game, I had two Storm Knights, a corporate ninja, and a Canadian mounted policeman. And the Mountie played a Nemesis card on a Kanawha ninja. And I, as a game master, forgot he was wounded, and I had four walls go chink, 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 and block him off from his ally, and then the ninja jumped in and proceeded to slaughter the Mountie. And that's how Lawrence the
Uh-oh.
Mountie died. But
Tragic.
that kind of thing is what I see as a cordon them off. They're no, you know, they cannot be affected. And then depending on that challenge, now, again, I was a bad game master back then, but I've learned about how to keep people's wounds in mind when we're playing, because that was one that I forgot and didn't ask and did some damage and it ended up killing them. So yeah, I like the theme of it. Did you have something?
I was gonna say, at least it was memorable.
Yes, it's one of those things, those type of things. Like when I had somebody failed a cook check, and I had him poison the he was trying to be a cook for the army, and ended up giving the entire army dysentery. And then 2 decades later, we play, and somebody fails the cook check, and I'm like, "Oh, the food tastes bad." And that player was like, "Wait, wait, 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 wait. You had me give an entire army dysentery." And I was like, "Yeah, and apparently I didn't read the actual skill that says it just makes the food taste bad. It doesn't make it, you know, poison." He's like, That was actually the same player as the Mountie. So
Nice.
back then in the early 90s, apparently I did not read rules and keep things in mind. Moving on, 18, tension mounts. Play at the start of,
Oh,
or did
we
I
still have
miss one?
17, right?
You skipped 17.
That card stuck to my other card. Yes. 17, borrow reality. When played, choose one other reality rated character present. For the rest of the scene, you are treated as if you were a. Choose one other reality. Okay, for the rest of the scene, you are treated as if you were a native of that reality and your own. It just confused me. The first time I read this before we started recording, it made sense, but because one says choose a reality rated character, and then it
Yeah,
says
another one.
it says you are treated as if you were a native of that reality and your own.
Yeah.
Okay, so the reality of that person who you chose, I guess. So Jay, your thoughts on borrow reality?
This is a really good one. Like the use of the law of acquisition, I think it's nice and flavorful. So that means if you have your buddy over here who's the cyber priest, you can use that to count as if you're from Cyber Papacy and grab his laser gun and start shooting at people with out of care in the world. Well, I mean, you'll still be one case, I guess, but less of a care in the world. So yeah, I really like this. It's very useful. Almost many ways it could come up. Yeah.
Mark, your thoughts on borrow reality?
Love this card. This is almost like the rule of two if it created a card. And you've got, I mean, this would be a great way to get rid of your four case contradictions if they all came from one reality and that was from somebody in your party, and you're like, yep, now I'm native, like Jason, I'm native over here and mine. So now I only disconnect on a one, a surge comes up, I roll a three. Oh, look at that. I didn't disconnect today because I'm native to that reality now. Okay, cool. Let's keep going. Beyond that, there's not a lot of bonus or benefit to this card other than cool factor. You don't get any possibilities from it. It doesn't give you any other Benny. But it's a very Torg card, and that in of itself is great, and I like it a lot. But from a game mechanical standpoint, yeah, you don't really get a whole lot out of it. Still like it.
I just thought, having this card, I'm from, say, Living Land, that guy's from Cyber Papacy, and I am in Isle. Hey, Cyber Papacy guy, I'm going to be basically a native of your reality and mine, and then I have Reality Surge, and I add Isle to the mix. That just again, how effective is it? There are those niche cases where it keeps you from counterdicting, becoming a higher counterdiction, or could possibly trigger something. But it's just cool. It does have that cool
I think
factor.
it's when you have villains that like to have talismans, so they have so you might be in Pan Pacifica, but there's a Nile talisman and you're fighting against Nile guys, or there's a nightmare tree or something. So that might, that's a way that it could come in handy,
But
but
we're
that doesn't
still on
happen
corner.
too
We're still
often.
on big corner cases,
Oh
and
yeah, they're corner case.
it's a
Although
fantastic card. It's
talismans
just
aren't
cool,
that
but
much of a corner.
they're not. But they don't pop
Yeah.
up that much
It's true.
unless you're somebody on the stream who writes that stuff, which we do. So.
No, I think it's a fun card. If nothing else, it's a fun card.
Yeah, very Torg.
So now we can move on to 18 tension mounts. Play at the start of a round during a dramatic skill resolution before the drama card is flipped. So very specific on when this card can be placed. Reduce the number of rounds to complete the DSR by one. Each Storm Knight gains two possibilities when completed. So Jay, tension mounts.
I like this one. It's totally on the players, if they want to do it or not. So they can't complain about it. Many DSRs I find do get completed early, unless they're like really serious ones. So it's quite doable. I guess it depends what you count as flipping the card, because if the game master gets to check through the top four with the other one earlier. So you use Kanawha's Tendrils, the GM chooses a card, but they haven't flipped it yet. Then you could still play this, right? So as the GM, be careful what you say. If you put it in, it's like, I made it easier for you guys. Like, all right, sweet, tension mounts. But yeah, I like it. It's good. It's up to the players.
Mark, your thoughts on tension mounts?
Not real clear. Play at the start of a round during a dramatic skill resolution before the drama card is flipped. It doesn't say start of the DSR, so you could be in the middle of this DSR already, and you're lessening the duration that you have at that time. And when you complete it, you're going to get your possibilities. You don't get them during the DSR. So now, chases are considered DSRs, so that would qualify. We don't. We tend to think of chases as something other than, but they are a DSR. They use that same mechanic, and so they count. If the intent of the card was to be played at the start of the DSR rather than at any other point, I might think about changing the wording on the front of it. If the intention was just, you can play it whenever you want to, okay, then okay. That might be a little bit cheesy. If you've knocked out A, B, and C, and you're sitting there on getting ready to you're working on D, and you've got your, as Jay pointed out, you hit an A, B, C on round one, and now you've got four rounds to finish off the last step of the DSR, and you're like, well, let me play this now. Okay. I mean, I don't know. It's It's a good card, and it is absolutely on the players. They get to choose whether or not they're going to put it down and make a take a stab at it. But it's a zero consequence. If you fail, there's no big deal other than you're failing the DSR. But this card doesn't cost you anything additional. But I would imagine failing a DSR has its own consequences. So.
Yeah, I like it. I'm even thinking, you know, hey, if the players are like, hey, we're already on step D, we still have two rounds to go, no problem. Let's shave off a round or shave off two rounds and play this card, and then that step doesn't appear. You know, so just because they're close to doing it, then they might have to do a last ditch effort, or with all the, you know, whatever the negatives add up to at the time. As Mark and I've experienced, I think Jay, you pretty much have it the same thing. DSRs in the original Torg, classic Torg, was 6 rounds. Torg Eternity is 5 rounds. And they still are very rarely failed. I think they're, I remember one definite, and there might be a second one, but that's about it. So this is more than likely able to get it done in 4 rounds, but there's always that chance you get that complication that pops up, that if you mess up in that one, you go back to step A, and now you've lost that round's worth of stuff, and you've taken off the end round. So while I think that it is a good bet that the players would be able to do this, it's not a guarantee. And I think
you don't want to play it on round 4 or 5 of the DSR.
Okay, let's move on to 19, flashback. Play to trigger a flashback.
And 20.
And 20, yes. Yeah. So you can just say 19 and 20 are both flashbacks. Play to trigger a flashback. See the Pan Pacifica source book. This card may not be played during combat. So, Jay, your thoughts on flashbacks?
This is really going to depend on your group, on how this works out. Personally, I love these. I love the Mastermind perk, the whole flashback mechanic that was introduced in Pan Pacifica. And, you know, I played it in other games, similar things. A lot of it depends on players being a little more creative than usual. And then still requires a reality skill test to pull it off, I believe. But you don't need to spend a possibility for it, unlike other versions where you would, if memory serves. But yeah, so you basically, outside of combat, which is the big thing here, you could just kind of change something. It gives the players a little bit more agency. And I always find as a GM, it's nice to kind of react to something like that you didn't plan. And there are limitations to this, and you still set the difficulty for how plausible it is. So it's not like they can pull something wildly crazy out of left field. But usually it can be something as simple as, oh, I packed this. I didn't do a requisition for it earlier, but we're going to have like a little scene where as I was leaving the briefing, the requisition guy comes and he's like, no, you're going to need this, you know, and passed it to me. Or we do a little scene where I'm talking to some thugs that are working for the guy, and I paid them a bit to, you know, take the night off, so there's less guards there. You know, there's all kinds of things that could happen. So I really, really like this. And there's only these two cards and the one perk, so it doesn't get like out of control, like sometimes happens in games that allow this, where like the players are just making stuff up constantly. That if they're all like playing and you're all in the same mind, it's very good if you're on the same wavelength. But sometimes players will just spam out cheesy stuff with no real care for what it means, just because it would be the best thing, not necessarily narratively the best. So in my experience, these kind of flashbacks are always best when you look at it narratively first and mechanically second. Would this be cool? Does it improve the story? Not just, do I get a +2 or something like that? Right. But I really like these.
Mark, your thoughts on flashback?
I love this card. This is flashbacks are a rule-approved retcon. that the you know you you're quite frequently the statement, well, I would have done this, or my character knows better, and they would have packed this thing, or they would have brought this, or they wouldn't have done this thing, and then you have to make that adjudication as to whether or not you're going to allow it, because that's typically a hindsight thing that the landscape has changed, and all of a sudden your player doesn't want to be where they are, or doing what they're doing, or not have something that they think they should have. And, well, I would have brought my shield, or I wouldn't have had my shield on because I'm using two hands, or whatever. And so it becomes a problematic. You've got to decide whether or not that makes sense. And if you allow those kinds of things to happen all the time, then all of a sudden, somebody's going to start taking advantage of it to their benefit, and then it becomes cheese. And yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. However, the flashback as dictated is a fantastic. It's almost like a retcon idea, retcon requisition, retcon contact, however you want to do it, that gives your player the ability to, I have an idea that would make this situation better, and here's how I'm going to implement my idea. I'm going to put this down, and we would have done, back in the, back here where when we were waiting at the cafe, I kind of logged on to the internet and sent an email to this guy that I know who's now here, and he's providing cover fire that distracted them, and so half the guys peeled away or whatever. Yeah, I'm with Jay on the, I highly encourage this to be a impetus for RP, an impetus for player creativity. In this is not a GM has to figure out how this thing works out. The player is doing it. And so you just sit back and you go, okay, well, so what's your flashback? And they lay it out, and it's not a, yeah, I managed to take a hover tank and fold it up into my portable hole and stick it in my back pocket, and now I'm whipping it out so that it can trundle over all the Edinos that are in front of us. That, I mean, that's like, you wait, what? But having met, you just passed, but when we passed that checkpoint that was manned by two hover tanks, I knew the guys that were on that one, and I said, we might need some help. When you guys get a chance, can you run over this way? Because we'll be operating over here. Yeah, sure, we'll meet you over there. And now you that you know, those are two very dramatically different ways to approach it. The play one player is being super cheesy, just wants a hover tank. The other one's being creative and making it fit in with the story, making it meld well with what's going on. And it's creativity on the player's part that works. Now you're coming up with a DN because the hover tank doesn't just, it's a tank. So
It's not
people go, why
free.
is the tank driving? Right. So you got to make a roll, but because everybody's going to wonder why the hover tank's going over there, and the commanding officer might stop the hover tank. Whatever. There's still a chance it's not going to happen, but you as the GM, you just have to sit there and go, well, that's a number, that's a 14, or that's a 12, or that's an 18, or whatever. And then they make the roll because they've decided how crazy they want to get, and let them get crazy, just give them a high number. Unless you're like, well, my players hit high numbers. Okay, then don't let them get, that's not, that doesn't make any sense. We're not doing that. That doesn't work for a flashback. Okay, you're the GM. You're Cosm. You decide what works and what doesn't, and what numbers get assigned and what don't. But it's a cool card. I love this card.
Yeah, I like this card a lot. It was one of those things where when I was introduced to the concept in other games, I wasn't quite sure how I would like it. And it really fits well, though, with a cinematic and TV series mentality of where sometimes you're there and then you get a flashback of what they did to get to that point. And you can there's a lot of advice and such for game masters. Sometimes start a scene in medias res in the middle of things. You just stay, hear what happened, and with these flashbacks, the players can add how they got to that place and what they did to prep. So I really like these cards. The perk I think is cool. I'm very glad this was introduced in Pan Pacifica. It brings a lot of player agency into it. And it's just really cool. So, sounds like we are all on agreement with those. So that is all of the Pan Pacific cards. Again, you can write us, email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. And like Antonio's email, we will read your email. If you have questions, we'll answer questions. If you have comments, like what this one is, we'll make some comments on it. And otherwise, thank you very much for either listening or watching us. And until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.